Let me ask you about some of the individual works that we heard in this show. Let's start with the next big thing, A Glacier Eats a Town. And this makes me wonder, of course, you grew up in Alaska, you grew up in Sitka. How prominently did Alaska influence that piece in particular, or just in general, how much does Sitka find its way into the work you're writing now in Seattle?
Yeah, it was pretty specific just in terms of, I think that this was a joke that my family was throwing around, as I recall, when I was growing up. The idea of the slow-moving tragedy.
George, I think it is the glacier. I think it's after the children.
Well, if that's true, what do we do? At this rate, it'll be through that wall in pi times radius squared, and carry the 2, 4, or 5 months.
Oh, my God.
And I have to admit that the next big thing, I enjoyed the piece, but I actually wrote it a fair chunk of time ago. I think I wrote it back in 97, 98. And while I was aware in general terms about global warming, I think that, you know, this is kind of a counterfactual piece. As we know, the real sort of slow-moving disaster is that the glaciers are receding and not coming towards us. But with that being said, yeah, Alaska's, growing up in Sitka, I think that the greatest influence on this and any other piece that I write is the way that an entire community is laid out for you in very... again, in sort of kind of distilled ways, in the same way that a 10-minute play has all of its comedy, tragedy, and whatever else sort of life shoved into it. One of the things that you learn growing up in a community like Sitka, which is this beautiful, isolated little community, is that everything in the world is present. It's just present in sort of miniature. So you're going to run across the same sort of people in the world. When you live in a larger city, they actually kind of run factions. In a place like Sitka, a faction might just be 1 or 2 or 3 people. So certainly when I was putting together my classic disaster movie cast, you have your panic geologist, you have your mayor who's obstructionist, you have your, you know, those are sort of archetypes that that I grew up knowing.
The next piece we performed was Important Dates in History.
Your drinking water. I headed on to 16th century Scotland and the court of Mary, Queen of Scots.
Tis me bonny, bonny Abe, come back to me.
How did you pick the different women throughout history that you were going to use in this piece?
I think that all kind of came about because I myself am someone who does like powerful women. And once I started to think about the way that you know, when you're out in the world dating, you do tend to kind of be drawn towards the same sort of person over and over again, at least for a while, until you either hit the jackpot and find someone who's the right fit for you, or just until you finally figure out that you're making the same mistake over and over again.
Then there was Lola Montez, who told great jokes but was a complete psycho who would go on and on about the Jesuits. And Jane Austen, who was all straight-laced and everything until you got a few drinks in her. Then, yeah! And Calamity Jane, who turned out to be
Once I kind of came up with that particular idea, history's got plenty of examples of strong women who either overcame their circumstances or used their circumstances, in the case of, like, Cleopatra. They sort of, you know, move forward. And so, more or less, I think that was the joke that I kind of found interesting and funny, was the idea that, that someone who has the opportunity to date anyone, to go anywhere, would tend to search out the same problem over and over and over again. Because, you know, as I said, that kind of that's the problem of modern life, isn't it? Everyone is in the world of dating is always trying to, they believe, sort of find a more perfect match, but all they're really doing is making the exact same mistake that they made the first time. They're just doing it with someone in wearing a different dress, wearing a different sort of persona.
Going. This is different than most. It's you know, times out to about 2 minutes. That's a lot to pack in. Where did that come from?
I was really lucky to be here in Seattle during a time when sketch comedy hit this amazing boom period in the late 90s, early aughts, where at one point there were over a dozen well-established, just wonderful sketch comedy groups. And I kind of always secretly wanted to be a member of one of those groups, just because sketch, which is kind of different from short plays, was always a form that really intrigued me. And I say it's different. The main reason it's different is that you've got a very specific, you aren't trying to develop characters. You aren't trying to say something larger. What you're trying to do is very specifically set up a scenario that makes people laugh.
It's the sale you wouldn't believe.
A one-of-a-kind offer that's so unique, it's just nuts.
It's our first.
And last.
Grand opening slash
we just lost our lease sale.
That's right. We thought I had a grand opening.
And I don't do a lot of sketch comedy writing, partially because I don't think it's really my forte. But with Going, it was partly sort of for the form kind of fuels this whole idea. The other one is when you live in a city, the number of times that you're walking past the place, whether it's a restaurant or a shop or something, and you think, oh, that's new. I really need to go in there. And then a week, it seems later, you're walking past and it's gone.
The grand opening slash lost our lease sale, located in that large white shop space with the big windows that used to have the boutique, and then before that sold greeting cards, and before that was a pharmacy or something, opened roughly from 10 to 5.
You never even had a shot at getting in that particular place, you know. And so the idea that there's such rapid turnover in so many cities of these places really made me kind of wonder, well, who exactly was trying to run a shop there anyway? Because it seemed like after having got the window display in, they weren't actually able to figure out a business model to keep people coming in. So that's more or less where that came from.
And I think that's true for big and small cities. I know during rehearsal, especially the narrator's last line about, you know, in that one place that used to be white and was maybe a pharmacy, and people, you know, commented that sounds like that line might have come directly from Sitka. But I think it's true of a lot of places.
I think it is, too. You know, my hat's off to anyone who's going to try a business. But one does end up being a little perplexed as to how exactly, you know, so many of these places that open, you sort of think, well, what was the plan here? Because certainly the person who went through the trouble of starting up the business didn't seem to have considered that question.
On to AKA.
You don't believe in multiple personalities, but you believe in past lives?
Well, of course. It just makes sense. How else can I explain my Irish accent?
What Irish accent?
The one I have when Bridget the maid visits. Here she is. Howdy! Hi there, darling. How are you?
That's not Irish. That's a bad southern accent.
It is not.
It is.
Bridget's from Southern Ireland, Cork.
Oh, please.
Well, let's hear one.
What I like about it personally is that what makes the people funny is not that they have these, you know, mental situations, mental conditions, but rather that they're just annoying and they're bad at life.
Yeah, I think, you know, we do live in a time of a tremendously confessional time, and it does hit me. I'm not trying to make fun of mental illness in any particular way, but it has hit me that a lot of people increasingly like to define themselves by their issues, by their problems, by their deficits, so that people, almost the first thing that you know about them when you meet them is that they step up and they say, well, you know, actually I've got this particular issue or that particular issue, with the same strange sort of pride, you know. I think a lot of people hold on to those things because they feel like it excuses bad behavior on their part.
Get at you.
Will you two stop screaming?
Look,
who are you?
I'm your waitress. Remember, I've had to listen to you two idiots all evening. None of the other wait staff would even come near you first because of your nauseous cooing, and then because of your competition to see who's got the most interesting mental disorder. Well, in my opinion, neither one of
there's
you
a,
are crazy.
There's a friend of mine that I had to pull up short after several years of knowing her, where she would start off almost every statement about bad behavior by saying, well, I was an only child. And one time, kind of in frustration, I said to her, yes, that was 35 years ago. You were an only child. You know, now you're an adult, and now you can kind of hopefully move past this initial sort of issue and problem that you have. but as I said, I think that people like to not only sort of embrace a label, which many people would sort of say, well, you know, isn't that something you would hope to overcome? But then use that as a way to excuse what sort of rash, obnoxious, unpleasant behavior that they might happen to get up to.